Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, insert random sponsor here, is proud to bring to you its international podcasting champions of the world, Precious Pat Henson, Big Sexy Scott Morris, the main event, Meeples! Welcome to, I guess, two in a row does make a trend, because this is our second episode now.
I thought it was three made a trend.
The old phrase is, you know, what is it? Two data points don't make a trend. So
yeah.
Now we're going to break that. We're going to say they do, right? So this is the second episode of Main Event Meeples. Thank you so much for joining us. And we appreciate everybody listening and commenting and catching up on social media and all the fun things in between. Pat, how are you?
I'm doing good today. How you doing, man?
I am alive again, just as I was last time we had this conversation.
This is a good thing.
Trying to maintain the status quo, as is said.
We're both at the age where, like, that's enough.
That sometimes, you know, you just got to find happiness in the small details, right? And sometimes just waking up and seeing the sunrise is good enough.
So. Yeah, you pretty much, yeah, like, it did, yeah. I'm just glad to wake up in the morning and just be like, okay, everything's where it was last night.
That is the profound wisdom.
I know where I am.
That is okay, the profound cool. wisdom of Precious Pat Henson. Yeah. All right. Well, of course, I am Big Sexy Scott Morris. Precious Pat Henson is joining us as well. We're going to be talking about a lot of really interesting topics today. So between... like last week, between our opener, our undercard, our midcard, and our main event, we each got a topic. And today, we said last week, we were going to start by asking each other's questions to learn a little bit about, like, more about us, each other, more so our listeners can enjoy and learn more about us and things like that. So today's opener question is, what did we see that we liked in gaming recently? Last week was about wrestling. This week's going to be about gaming. So I know what my topic is, and I know what your topic is, and I'm really curious where you're going to go with this, because I don't know if you're going in the positive direction or the negative direction, but I want you to begin, if that's okay.
Yeah. Mine isn't so much about physical games, and this sort of started as a conversation around 3D printing, and I'm really interested in, and we'll have to make this a whole topic about how 3D printing impacts y'all's business as board games. You know,
sure.
Like, do you become a company that just writes rules and then makes STL files and gives them to people? Is the money in, well, we're going to make something that's really well crafted, and that's what we give you, and it's special, or is it about the rules? But really. You know, as I've watched more streaming of late, just started to think about, like, man, there's a lot of games that I haven't bought in my life. And I didn't buy them because, you know, money exists and it has to pay for things. And I didn't have the spare money or the time to play the game. And I wonder if for people, and I have no metrics on this at all, but is watching someone stream a game an alternative to piracy? Like, instead of pirating the game, they're watching someone play it. And so they're getting the experience. And this was just something that I saw randomly on some article header. And it just started me thinking about it. But the idea being, you know, is the fact that I can watch somebody play this game without having to invest in it myself an alternative to stealing it, as maybe somebody would have before?
So, in other words, it's not the concept of I'm a bad guy or a bad girl and I want to go download a game or anything. It's not that you're saying that I'm trying to be a bad actor and I'm looking for an alternative. It's that instead of being a bad actor, I have the opportunity to watch other people play the game, share in that experience, get some of the same like dopamine rush I would get as if I was playing it myself, just obviously without making the decisions, right?
Yeah, and especially if it's like story based and story driven, if your goal is to get to the end of the story, then great. Like, you can watch somebody do that and have a community to interact with. And it's a lot of fun. And we'll talk about, you know, kind of the remote versus local idea later and the virtual experience and what it can bring you. But I just thought it was interesting. I really liked the idea that streamers offer a different way to experience games that changes kind of the way that people see them. And I would love to see metrics on whether or not, you know, if a game is highly streamed, is it pirated less?
I would be curious if a game is highly streamed, if it has a greater revenue generation after it starts to be streamed, right?
Yeah.
If you think, you know, obviously the A-plus titles that are, you know, really, really marketed and heavily put out there, you know, and it's like a Mario game, right? Like, that's not going to have an effect like this. But something that's an indie developer or somebody that is, you know, a first-time publisher, or maybe just a first-time in the mainstream publisher, I could see how things go up. You know, ironically, I just read an article. One of my favorite video games to play right now is Humankind from Amplitude. And it was talking about how the numbers had gone down based on the number of people that were playing on Steam. And they could track, you know, how many people were playing online and everything. And I thought it was interesting that they said that they couldn't capture the numbers from things like Microsoft Game Pass. So things that weren't necessarily managed like a Steam would. So while one went down, maybe others went up. But it is interesting because I think one of the biggest things about streaming in general, whether it's a board game or a video game or anything, is the ability to share in the experience, right? You get the opportunity to sit down and, you know, go through an adventure without making the decisions maybe, but go through an adventure with the person doing it. So that's an interesting topic. I would love to know if anyone listening has actually ever said to themselves, I was going to pirate this, but instead I'm going to watch it on Twitch or whatever the platform of your choice might be, you know, Facebook streaming or anything like that. I know that I don't know about your feelings on piracy, but obviously in my line of work with board games, there's a lot more physical art. It's digital, of course, as well, but there's a lot more physical art. And I've always felt that any kind of piracy is completely counterintuitive to what you actually want from those things that you love, right? Like, if you made a game, let's say a video game, and I loved it, and I walked away going, wow, Precious Pat Henson makes the best video games ever.
Yeah.
If I steal it and pirate it, the odds of you being able to make another game go down.
Yeah.
So why would I not want to spend the money if it's something that I feel was made really good to make sure that the people that are making the things I love can make more of the things I love?
Does that make sense? That's totally true. And all I will say about my attitude towards piracy is yar. But it's all about scale, and it's all about what's being, you know, what's being pirated. When I look at comic books, the margins and the numbers on those are so small now. And also, if you're going to pirate an indie book that's self-published, like, shut up and go away, you know, like, go away, you know, you're as close to taking money directly out of the creator's pocket as you can get.
Pretty much.
And you don't have those books live and die by that Wednesday sales number. And if you want more of them, you have to support it with money. Marvel and DC, that's, you know, they're going to have huge, huge comics that are going to do really well in billion-dollar properties and stuff. But still, those numbers are still small. They're not what they were in the 90s. They're not, you know, a book does well now if it sells 30,000 copies, which is sad in a lot of ways because it's just, you know, it's probably one of my other lifelong loves is talking about comic books.
So ironically, that's why I don't release a game on a Wednesday. So whenever I've made games from a publishing standpoint, I specifically don't release the games as a street date on a Wednesday because I don't want it to compete with independent comics.
Nice.
And I mean, any game could easily compete with Marvel and DC just because Marvel and DC fanboys are going to do their stuff. But if someone's at a shop and they have a choice between the latest independent comic or a brand new board game, I want them to be able to have the option for both. Mm-hmm. And I'd rather stagger that, you know, out like 2 or 3 days to give them the option to manage things as much as they can. So actually, I try to actually shoot for Fridays rather than Wednesdays, but that's a longer story altogether. Yeah. So,
yeah. And at some point I will rant about the changes the Comixology is making to their webpage, and it's,
that'd be a good topic.
Yeah. So what
that'd be a good topic for a friend of ours to join us.
Yeah.
Too, I know someone very good that would be cool to bring passion around there.
So Big Sexy, burn for that. Scott, what did you see that you enjoyed in gaming?
I saw a news article and it kind of threw me a little bit for a loop at first. I knew that this had been in talks, but I didn't know it was as close to being finished as it was. But recently, the United Paizo Workers was created, which is essentially 30 plus some odd number of the members of Paizo, which, so anyone who plays role-playing games is going to know them from Pathfinder and Starfinder.
Okay.
They basically unionized. And they came together to form this United Paizo Workers. And there was a lot of dramatic statements that were made and very some concerning statements in terms of, like, you know, how management has handled things and how maybe the employees are handled and things like that. And I don't want to get into the political side of this thing at all because it is very charged. But it's obviously the first ever union for a board game company or a board game staff. And given the fact that, you know, there are some pretty big companies out there, right? You have people like Asmodee, you have people like Wizards of the Coast, you know, pretty big corporations. And unionization is not easy. It's not a simple thing. It takes time. It's a legal battle. There's a lot to go on there. And no matter what side of the fence you may sit on, whether you're in support of it or whether you're against it, I have to really tip my hat to these people because this is not easy.
Yeah.
This is not an industry where they, if something goes wrong and the politicalness of this comes together and basically Paizo says, okay, you're all fired, get out of here, we don't want you doing this. Which I don't think would happen, and obviously didn't happen because they're unionized now.
Right.
But I mean, if that was the worst case scenario, 30 people in the board game industry all needing work at the same time is pretty darn high.
Yeah.
And
I can imagine.
You know, there's a lot of people in the board game industry that are what I call the garage bands, right? It's two people in a garage doing their best to be as creative and business minded as possible. So for 30 plus talented people, especially in the role playing side of the industry, which is pretty much Dungeons and Dragons, Pathfinder, and a whole bunch of other things.
Yeah.
And
a whole bunch of
that's a,
you know, this book sold to 20 people. We were really happy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, transparently, there are a lot of independent role-playing games that are doing extremely, extremely well, but nothing that's ever going to, you know, crack the surface of like a Pathfinder or a D&D right now. Right. But that's okay. You can still have micro successes inside of this environment. I just think from a personal standpoint of looking at it as to how much work this had to take and how much strain and stress and how much frustration and concern and anxiety and worry and like every emotion that these people must have felt trying to put this union together, I just got to tip my hat to them because I think it's an amazing accomplishment. Again, no, regardless of where you sit in the whole politicalization of, you know, unions are good, unions are bad or anything like that, the fact that they were able to do that and do it, I mean, honestly, like we talked about at the beginning, sometimes you're just happy to be alive. Today's day and age is not easy to do anything. Just changing a microwave can take like months. I mean, it's just crazy. So I saw that and I had to give a tip of the hat to them. I think it's a really amazing accomplishment. And who knows? I mean, there's a lot of change happening in the industry overall. Who knows how this is going to affect it or what it may lead to in anything. But at the end of the day, if it provides a better product and it provides a better end result for the users of the game, then I'm all for it, because ultimately that's what puts smiles on everybody's faces. Yeah. So that's what I saw.
And so, yeah. Yeah. Paizo is also a great example of having that perfect moment to bring out your product. You know, as D&D went to a completely different format, and they were like, yeah, we have this moment to create Pathfinder, and then became a thing about it. And it's to know that they're people are unionized, like you said, it's a huge effort, but it's good on their management for giving them the opportunity to make the decision as an employee group.
Yeah, I can't imagine those decisions or those discussions were easy. No. So, I mean, that's, like I said, stress, anxiety, frustration. So, tip of the hat, Paizo workers. Very, very well done.
Ladies and gentlemen, today's undercard. To dark or not to dark. With Big Sexy Scott Morris. While Precious Pat Henson fanboys over the genius of Bryce Rensburg and Aubrey Edwards.
So this is going to be fun because I just had a argument / aggressive negotiation type discussion with someone online about who was better, Rensburg or Aubrey Edwards. So I think that discussion is going to be really interesting. I think my discussion is going to upset some people. So my
now pathway, I really want to hear this.
my pathway to being a super fan of AEW really started. I mean, it started when everything announced and you know they sold out and started everything from an all in perspective. But where I really flipped the switch and went, I'm all in on AEW, was Hell in a Cell 2019, which was. Yeah, if you haven't seen it,
don't.
It was The Fiend versus Seth Rollins in what could have been a huge turning point. Well, I guess technically it was a huge turning point, just not in the direction that they wanted to turn the ship. I get really frustrated when things that are meant to be important get diminished. And watching Hell in a Cell finish for the second time in a row of a no disqualification match being ended in a basically DQ ending. That was really frustrating. You know, the prior year you had Brock Lesnar break into the cage in 2018 against Roman and it just ended and everyone was like, what? And then they did the same thing in 2019. Ironically, they did the same thing in 2020, but we'll talk about that later. So when that happened, I was like, okay, this booking and this storyline and this logic, I'm past it. I need to look for something better. And the very first thing that I noticed when I started to watch AEW Dynamite regularly when it started was I had so much more time on my hands. I wasn't watching a 3-hour show from Raw, which quite honestly, an hour of that is just recaps. It's very insulting to me that people think that if you're watching a wrestling match or a wrestling show and you come back from commercial that they have to recap the last 20 minutes like you weren't there for the last 20 minutes. I'm like, I'm here. And most people are here for the long haul, right? And even if you do need to recap, you don't need to recap every single segment, which is kind of crazy. So I noticed knocking out Raw 3 hours, knocking out SmackDown 2 hours. I suddenly had so much more time on my hands. And I was like, this is great. I'm more productive in my life. I'm getting more things done. I'm spending more time with my family. Like, it's phenomenal. And then after Dynamite, it was, hey, we're going to announce Dark. Oh, okay, what's Dark? Oh, Dark is a YouTube show, and it's going to have all the up-and-comers, which for someone like me, I love watching these younger wrestlers. Like, I love being able to look at someone and go, I was there when that guy came out, right? And it's very exciting. But it can be kind of long in the tooth. Mm-hmm. I've seen some of those be like 2.5, almost 3 hours. Which, I mean, they're YouTube, right? So cool. I mean, you can do all that stuff. You don't have to worry about it. But then Dark Elevation happened. Mm-hmm. And it was, well, what is this? Like, is this more Dark? Is it better than Dark? Is it worse than Dark? Where does it sit in the hierarchy, right? And I think that that was all kind of very confusing. So when Rampage was announced to be an hour, I was really excited about that.
Yeah.
Because I was like, this is great. It's another show, but it's not overblown. And the other night when Rampage was 2 hours, I started realizing that means there's 2 hours of Dark Elevation. There's 2 hours of Dark. There's 2 hours of Dynamite. There's 2 hours. Wait a minute. All my time is gone again. Yeah. I'm like, where did this all go?
That's absolutely true.
So there's part of me that's asking myself, is there too much AEW TV just in general, across TV and across YouTube? I personally think, and I'd love your opinion on this because I know you really like a lot of the announcing teams that are on Dark and Dark Elevation, but I look at Dark and Dark Elevation as a way for them to highlight younger talent and give younger talent ring time and screen time and crowd time. But more often than not, what I've seen on Elevation and on Dark is actually shining a light on people who really aren't ready. And there's a lot of people that slip moves or miss moves and do it in a way that kind of makes you question, is this person just too green to be here right now? Yeah. Or what's going on? So what do you think? Do you think there's too much TV in general? Or do you think it should just be, you know what, Scott, shut up and let people enjoy what they want to enjoy. And if they want to watch 20 hours of wrestling a week, they can watch 20 hours of wrestling a week.
But to, you know, borrow a phrase from Tony Khan, our Lord and Savior, as the AEW super fans, watch your wrestling. Like, if you want to watch, you know, hundreds of hours of stuff, you know, back in the day, reading the recaps on 411 Mania and realizing that Larry Zonka watched like 80 to 90 hours of wrestling like per week, it was just crazy. And if I want to keep up with New Japan and I want to keep up with AEW and I want to, you know, peek in on WWE, see what they're doing, there's not enough hours in the day. And the way that I've come to watch Dark or Elevation is just, it's something on, you know, and it's, if I see somebody that's interesting, I'm going to peek into it. I will, you know, skip through some things if, you know, it's like, okay, this is going to be a squash and I'm not having as much fun with it. The thing is occasionally they'll bring out guys like, they'll have Eddie Kingston come and do commentary. And
right.
Every time I'm like, yeah, I'm out of that. I'm not really. They'll be like, Eddie's going to do commentary. I'm like, oh, what? You know, and his interplay with Shivani is a lot of fun. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, but this is like the seventh squash match in a row. Yeah. And some of these guys aren't ready. And or some of them are just like, you know. Like that's, and to be fair, that's one of the things that makes Fuego del Sol so special. Is the guy got over in the middle of that. He got over being a squashy, you know, over and over again. But like the opportunity for those guys to grow organically and grow and seeing their improvement has been really cool. Watching Jungle Boy get better, watching Ty Conti get better, watching a lot of people get better has been really entertaining. You just got to, I don't know, with Dark and Dark Elevation, you kind of have to pick and choose, but it's, I don't think it's required by any means. They're going to continue to do it because of something. And I don't know if this is because of what Janela said. He mentioned that, you know, sometimes you just got to get in the ring and do stuff. And at the beginning of AEW, if you weren't on TV, you weren't doing anything.
Yeah.
And they, you know, he was like, man, I need to move. I need to do it. I'm rusty. And Dark Elevation gives them an opportunity to do that. You know, the other thing is those two things came about in their, you know, current form during the pandemic when they could just film it in Jacksonville and it was no big deal. You know, all it cost them was keeping the lights on. And
sure. 2 p.m. Let's fire it
up. Yeah, let's fire it up and let's get some people some work and you can go back and you can coach and do a lot of good from that. What's hilarious is when you try to translate some of that to TV, and you get, occasionally you'll get somebody who really shines through. Like, you know, Red Velvet has a lot of potential. She's not quite there yet. And if you saw Rose at the Top, she's not there yet. But a guy like Big Shoddy Lee Johnson. You know, that was a dark guy who you watch grow through the process. And, you know, now is an opportunity to be better. And having the opportunity to hone your craft over and over again every week and having an outlet for it, if you're not one of the major stars, is a really good thing. And the fact that they don't, they'll run storylines from dark and they'll bring those to TV occasionally. And that's where QT Marshall kind of became a heel, was his feud with Fuego. But it rarely is required viewing. So it's, if you want to watch it, great.
So I think the answer that I'm hearing is to dark if you want to.
Yeah. No, I think it's a,
which I think is a great answer.
Yeah, I think it's a buffet in that way. You know, it's like,
there you go.
If you want to dig into this, it's great. If you don't, like
the AEB, the All Elite Buffet.
Yeah, there you go.
So my argument on Twitter this week, because it's Twitter and you have to argue, yeah, right? It was about who was your favorite referee. And I made a comment about how Bryce Remsburg was super awesome, entertaining, I thought, and Aubrey Edwards was great. And I kind of gave the nod to Aubrey Edwards. And ironically, I just showed my wife the Invisible Stan versus Invisible Man match GCW that Bryce Remsburg refereed.
So good.
And she laughed so hard at that. And she said to me, she's like, this is the most idiotic, stupid thing I've ever seen. And I love that everybody just went with it.
Yeah.
So well, that, I think it's great.
And that doesn't happen unless a crowd is completely into it. The announcers were completely, like, everybody was there for it. But if Remsburg doesn't go nuts and just really get into it, it doesn't work. And he just, it's a tour de, as Adam Blabia said, it's a tour de force by the guy. It's so great.
It is. It showed also what referees mean as that third person in the ring, right? So I'm curious, your topic is the genius of Bryce Remsburg and Aubrey Edwards. Fire it up.
Yeah. So this came from something that's been kind of stewing in my head, but also it reached ahead with the best image from the Danielson Suzuki match is
yes,
is when Minoru hits Danielson with a forearm and he goes down like a sack of potatoes, and Remsburg just puts his hand over his mouth, just like, oh my God, you know,
he's dead.
I think he's dead. And he's
dead, Jim.
He's too shocked to like be a ref and check on him. He's so just like, oh my God, he's dead. And the fun part about that was how into the match he was. And in so many ways, when you're watching Remsburg, he kind of is you in the ring to a degree. And like, you have a lot of fun with it. Also, he's the kind of guy who has enough of a sense of humor about himself that when Suzuki turns around and starts, you know, fixing his shirt and just got to pat him on the chest, like, go away. It was fantastic. And he does that. The Invisible Man versus Invisible Stan is, if you haven't seen it, just, it's on YouTube. It's amazing. But he just elevates the matches he's in, and you never see him get in the way. The way that a lot of refs will, like, if there is a ref moment in AEW in general where the ref is involved in the story, it's almost always purely just a distraction. I don't remember the last time I saw a true, like, ref bump, you know, where, like,
yeah,
we knocked the ref cold and, you know, now.
Was there a ref bump? Oh, this is going to test my memory. Was there a ref bump in the Moxley and Omega match where he won the world title, or was that a distraction?
I think it was a distraction.
Callis distracted him. And then threw the microphone in. Yeah.
Threw the microphone in. And you don't see that. They add to the match.
Boy, that's a good point. I didn't even think about that. Like, how, I bet you could probably count on two, if not one hands, the number of ref bumps that have happened in AEW.
Yeah. Whereas in New Japan, it's a constant. Whereas in, I mean,
yeah, but Red Shoes can take it.
Yeah, Red Shoes can take it until suddenly it's matters and he can't. But it's kind of, that's part of their show. And in WWE, it's just another thing they use to just not have actual finishes. But the fun of it is like the ref is a third actor. In Aubrey Edwards, if you've seen AEW live, you understand something. And it's unbelievable. And you have to be at a live show to experience it. I have never seen a ref over like Aubrey Edwards. Aubrey is over as all get out, and she gets a crowd pop when she comes out, which is nuts. You know, she's a ref.
The only ref that I could imagine prior to AEW existing that would get a reaction was the kind of stereotypical, everyone expected it, you screwed Brett when Hebner would come out.
Yeah, Hebner drew reaction.
And that was not a positive heat, right? That for a long time, that was X-Pac heat. For a long time, that was, we don't care how long you've been here or what you've done, you screwed our hero, right? But when you and I both went to the Austin show for AEW on February 12th in 2020, right before the pandemic kind of kicked in, that was unbelievable because, you know, beginning of the night, JR comes out, gets his pop because it's JR and everyone
it's in Austin and that's the one place in the country he's going to get booed.
He did get booed for the Boomer Sooner, but once the Boomer Sooner ended, everyone kind of gave him his respect and everything. But man, Aubrey came out and it was like fireworks. Yeah. She could have come out to Pyro if she wanted, I think, which is amazing.
That, and a side note, you don't realize how good Justin Edwards is until you've been at a live show. He's amazing.
That's true.
He's absolutely amazing. But the match, if you want to understand, like, first of all, Aubrey Edwards understands something that The Rock understood, and The Rock made a big deal. And they give him a hard time in Jumanji in the movie. It's one of the better scenes in the movie where his overdone facial expressions and how like overdone he is. Well, the thing is, he understands that ultimately wrestling is a stage show. He's playing to the guy in the back of the building. And Aubrey refs like she's in a stage play. She refs, all of her motions are just these overdramatic things, but they work so well to like really just get you into that moment of like when somebody's struggling in a submission, just the hands out gesture that she does, and she just looks at you like, are you all right? And it's the most intense, wonderful thing. And she,
it's high drama.
Yeah, it's high drama. Well, the kind of the apex of it was the Jericho versus MJF match where she counts Jericho out 1, 2, 3, and she doesn't see him put his foot on the rope and she does her job. And then as soon as the match is over, everything about her just dies. Like her body language, her face, everything is just dead. And she wanted to do literally anything else than raise Max's hand. First of all, it's a sign of how good Max is as a heel. It's also a commentary on how good she is at putting him over. Like, she hates him, and she's still gonna count the three because she's an impartial ref. But she's just fantastic, and she makes the matches she's a part of better. And it's,
my favorite, it's Aubrey Edwards moment just happened recently. Oh, yeah? Actually, it was Jungle Boy and Adam Cole. And when Adam Cole hit him with the Panama Sunrise and covered him, and she counted 2 99/100ths, and he kicked out, and the look on her face and Cole looking at her when she was like, it's 2, man.
Yeah.
It's 2. Like she couldn't, and he was in shock, and she couldn't believe it was 2. It was like, you know, the wrestler always has to have that look of shock, like, how did my move not finish this? But the fact that Aubrey was like almost mirroring what Adam Cole was like, I don't understand how this didn't end either. Right. Yeah, like, that was just so good of a moment.
And by the way, if you haven't watched that match, go watch that match. It's like watching two really great guys in the first round of a good fight that I think is going to go for a long time.
Yeah.
Like Jungle Boy, Adam Cole is going to be really good for a long time. Also, you can see Adam Cole teaching Jungle Boy in the ring.
Yeah.
The wisdom of Shawn Michaels of pacing and slowing down and not going big right away and over again. It's just, that match is so good. And again, Aubrey does so much to add to that. And Bryce, when he's in those matches, does so much to add to that, where they help draw in the crowd with how they officiate the match. And you notice the two of them because of how good they are at pulling you in to the story. I don't know the name of anybody else on the AEW. Like, I know Rick Knox, but like,
sure, everyone knows Rick Knox. He counts three for the Young Bucks.
Yeah, but he's not like, nothing about what he does in the ring is anything that I would consider great. You know, he's just kind of there.
He's very efficient.
Yeah,
he's a very efficient referee. And I think to me, that's the thing that Bryce and Aubrey do very well, is that referees should not steal the show. Referees should not be the focal point. They should always be that extra person in the ring. But when the moment arises, I mean, I remember, I think it was MJF. It might have been MJF versus Moxley was the match where he got up in Aubrey's face and like bumped her. Like kind of like, you know, chest bumped her, and she got so angry and right back up in his face. And it's like, that's a moment where, yes, the referee does become the focal point of that moment, but it immediately went right back to the match, like right afterwards. But it was strong enough and it was powerful enough. I still feel that when it happens, whoever it is that lays their hands on Aubrey the first time is going to become the most hated heel in AEW, like instantaneously. Because Aubrey's at that level where the fans are like, that's our ref.
Yeah,
absolutely. That's our ref, right?
Oh, I think if I told, you know, my wife that somebody put hands on Aubrey Edwards, she'd be like, did they live?
Them's fighting words, yeah. <You know? laughs>
That's exactly did they live right. together? And the thing is, that person would be in mortal danger. I think the crowd would be like, oh, no. Oh, no.
And, you know, I haven't had a chance to see much of Bryce outside of AEW. But even, I guess, just outside the ring of AEW, you know, Aubrey does the Unrestricted podcast with Tony Schiavone, which I think is a great podcast. And listening to Aubrey talk, Aubrey, the woman, the person, is so much different than Aubrey Edwards, the character, the referee. You know, when she gets in that ring and the stripes are on, it is business. It is, this is my job and I'm going to make this work and it's going to go well. And when she's on Unrestricted, she's so cut loose and she's so like not the referee in the ring, which is cool because it's two sides of her, right? And you get to see both sides of that. But I definitely feel like Bryce and Aubrey are people I could drink some beers with and have some good times with.
I think so too. And I think they do nothing but add to what they're part of. And I just love watching matches that they're a part of.
I have a good feeling most of our audience would not disagree with you. So
there you go.
All right, we are off to the Midcard.
Tonight's Midcard. Scott asks a dumb question about how many championships there are. And Pat pines for the days when wrestling tournaments weren't obvious who the winner was going to be at the end.
Oh, I know where you're going with this. So just recently, as we're recording this right now, it is the 18th of October, 2021, in the year of our whatever you worship. And we just had the brackets for the World Title Eliminator Tournament. Yeah, so we just had the brackets for the World Title Eliminator Tournament announced. And this is, I don't know, is it good? You tell me.
It's irritating because you look at it and you're like, I'm like trying to talk myself up into possibilities, you know, like, I don't know, man.
Eddie can win. Sure. Eddie's got a shot.
I'm sure. Eddie's got any shot at all. Maybe, you know, I think while I would enjoy Eddie versus Danielson, I would rather see Lance Archer versus Danielson just because
that's interesting.
Danielson is so good against a big man. And it would give Archer a chance to just look like an absolute monster. So that'd be a cool match. I don't want to, like, and the idea of Moxley versus Orange Cassidy is really fun. And while the don't care about anything attitude that Moxley has is against Cassidy's shenanigans, I'd rather watch Moxley against Powerhouse Hobbs. I mean, Orange Cassidy versus Hobbs is going to be fun, but that feels like a match I've seen. You know, like, I don't think You know, I don't think I'm going to see anything that I don't expect. I think we're going to see Moxley and Danielson as your winners in the tournament. The match is going to be the two of them. Also, and from a business perspective, that's a good decision. You know, you've got two guys that are going to bring WWE casuals to your pay-per-view, which is a great idea. It's especially good because that's the night you're probably going to crown Hangman Page as your champion. And so you're going to see this moment that's a huge deal for the AEW faithful, that match is a match that we didn't get to see properly in WWE, where we let these two guys really have a lot of fun. And I would enjoy it to see it. But wrestling tournaments in general can be really, really fun if done well. You know, obviously, kind of to me, the in the U.S., the gold standard is WrestleMania 4 and Survivor Series 98. WrestleMania 4 is wonderful for so many different reasons, but also because, like, that was one of the first real, like, wrestling memories I have, was trying to find out the next day, the Monday after, like, looking at the newspaper and being like, do they have the results? Like, I watched the main event leading up to it. I totally knew it was going to happen. Did Macho Man win? Because he was my guy. And I was a young child. That was a beginning of thing of like, oh, this isn't real, you know.
But you're right, because that was really the first time a major tournament took place in the U.S. that was going to be televised. I mean, the WWE had done one of my favorites, actually, the Wrestling Classic, prior to that, which ironically Macho Man won that too. And but you could argue, I think, a lot that the success of WrestleMania 4's main event was really that had the seeds planted at WrestleMania 3 with the Intercontinental match between Ricky Steamboat and Randy Savage. I mean, anyone that tells me that's not in their top 10 matches of all time, like, we got to have a talk.
Yeah, no, I worry about you.
Survivor Series 98, though, that was the Deadly Game.
Yes, it was.
Right? That's what it was called. Yeah, that was okay. Now I'm going to stretch my memory back on this one, because
we watched
this was during the Attitude Era, and if I remember right, this was the Rock's night.
Yeah.
I remember, right?
And it was the night Rock went into it as a face.
Yep.
And he was going against I don't remember if they were the corporate ministry yet or not, but they were the corporation. And the whole pay-per-view is one story. And it's a story of Rock getting to the end of the pay-per-view. And this is the year after Survivor Series.
The Montreal Screwjob.
And you know, you want to follow that. But you've got this wonderful story of the Rock finally getting there. And he's the people's champ, whether he's got the belt or not. And everybody loves him. And going into it, everybody loves him. And Mankind had been like the steady lackey of the McMahons the whole time. And he was perfectly fine with doing the job, or, you know, beating up the Rock and challenging, making challenges he shouldn't have made. And the Rock was just awesome. This was his first championship. He came out and he was great. And then the balls on Vince McMahon, which is an interesting sentence, to have that ending where it straight up
emulated 97.
And what was hilarious is I had been out of watching wrestling, and I'm watching it with you live in San Marcos, and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe they did that ending. And I was like, why? Is that a big deal? And you were like, oh. And you had to tell me about the screw job, because I had never heard about it a year prior, because my wrestling watching was just like, I watched what was on TV and that was all I watched. You know, but like, those things are fun, you know, when you can build a pay-per-view around it. I mean, King of the Ring made two or three guys, you know, amazing stars. I mean, arguably the most important promo of the Attitude Era happens as a result of the King of the Ring. You know, you quote your Bible verse saying John 3:16, Lawson 3:16, you know, and it was amazing. And you get, you know, that's Macho Man had his apex as a result. It also created the Mega Powers, which was an incredible storyline that really, you know, started in WrestleMania 3 and went all the way to 5. You had, you know, the Deadly Game was fantastic also because Stone Cold didn't have to be the guy. You know, he could be right around it. And you cemented the Mr. McMahon character as not just Austin's bad guy, but everybody's bad guy. And you minted The Rock as the man. And you took a guy who was right there and minted him and made him a star. And New Japan gets this better than anybody with the G1.
I was going to say, we got to talk about the G1 because that's the pinnacle.
That's right? Yeah, absolutely. And think about the G1 is that's a month of television or a month of shows. And somehow those guys consistently every year pull out the best matches of the year against one another over and over again.
And I, I would venture to say that in the last probably 4 years, maybe 5 years, I don't feel as though when a G1 set was announced that you immediately knew who was going to win.
Yeah.
You knew who maybe top two, top three guys right might be in that bracket, but to point at and go, ah, Naito's going to win. Like it's not very obvious. And when you compare the world title, the men's world title eliminator tournament brackets that just got announced in AEW this week to the AEW women's world title eliminator tournament that happened where it was split between America and Japan. I remember when they made that announcement, I looked at it. I'm like, this is anybody's.
Yeah.
Like literally anybody could win this. We're going to get introduced to wonderful, amazing Japanese women wrestlers that the US public barely ever gets to see. And we're going to get some of the best US women's wrestlers that are in AEW coming together. And that I thought that tournament was phenomenal.
Yeah, I thought it was really good.
I know people argued and complained a little bit about maybe the setting at which the Japanese matches took place. But if you're a New Japan fan or you're just a Japanese wrestling fan in general, that didn't bother you at all because you're used to seeing that type of environment.
Yeah, that was relatively normal.
And I would venture to say that there are even some future seeds planted for future stars from that tournament, right?
Yeah.
And in a way, I would even argue when you were talking about Survivor Series 98, while it cemented The Rock and it cemented Mr. McMahon, I think it also cemented Mankind.
I agree.
I think that was the moment where The Rock turning over the course of that pay-per-view on the people, on the people's champion.
He didn't turn over the course of the pay-per-view. He turned at the last match.
At the last match, right.
You know, and he did it on Mankind, and he suddenly made a guy that everybody kind of wanted to root for anyway, and Mick Foley, absolutely storyline sympathetic. And it was
And awesome. I feel a little bit for Danielson because I feel like this kind of takes the wind out of his sails from this comeback.
Yeah.
And it's like, and here's my whole thing. I understand you can't put everybody in the tournament. You can't put, you know, a bunch of guys that are undefeated in a tournament because then you're going to end up with some really screwy endings or have to work around things. Like, you know, Sammy Guevara beating Miro for the TNT title is huge. And it feels huge because Miro was built up to be so unstoppable. And if Malakai Black were to go in and fight Danielson, which please God let that happen at some point in my life, that it would almost take away from the tournament.
Yeah.
But at the same time, and this is no disrespect to the man because I love the man. Like I kiss him on the lips. I love him that much. He's such a good dude. Dustin Rhodes just is like the odd man out in this thing.
Yeah.
And he draws Bryan Danielson first. I don't even think the most casual of AEW fan is going to say to themselves, oh, Dustin's a threat.
Yeah.
He's not. So you know that Danielson's going to walk through that match. And then on the bottom side of that bracket, you've got Archer and Eddie Kingston, which that's going to be a great
match. That's going to be a lot of fun.
It's already been a great match. The winner of that, and I really don't care who wins that. I mean, I love Eddie. I'm from New York, so Eddie rocks. But, I mean, Eddie versus Danielson is going to be super stiff and awesome. Archer versus Danielson is going to be super stiff and awesome. And you mentioned earlier about how he does so well with big guys. That match against Brock Lesnar at Survivor Series a couple of years ago was amazing. Yeah. I mean, so that was good. A match that almost had my wife, like, actually believing Brock Lesnar's great, and she hates Brock Lesnar. Yeah. So that was, it was really, really good. But then on the flip side, you've got, again, kind of a cakewalk for Jon Moxley to get to the finals as well. So,
yeah, I mean, Orange Cassidy is one of those guys that, like, you can never, never bet against in a lot of ways, because he always seems to find a way to get through these things. And frankly, Danielson versus Orange Cassidy.
Sure.
That would be so much fun, because you get to play on the sense of humor of Daniel Bryan or Bryan Danielson, but that shouldn't be a final, you know?
Like, no, it should not be a final. And that should be a Rampage match.
I don't know. I you put that on Dynamite. I think you could main event Dynamite with that.
I think you could too. Well, that depends on if they ever decide if they want to make Orange Cassidy a main eventer or not. It seems to rubber band more than his pants do. So
yeah. Yeah. The thing is the guy's bulletproof at this point. Like, his shtick is so over that they can insert him whenever they want. He is also a guy whose entire character is about making everybody in the back laugh. You know, that's how it started, was he wanted to make the guys in the back laugh. And then somehow it got over, because in PWG, of course it got over. You know, that's just, of course. That's how that place works. But you have that guy who just, he, like Naito, captured something that was going on in the world and just brought it into the ring. And you have all these smart fans who in general really liked him. And he then got the crowning achievement of being labeled by Jim Cornette as just a waste of space, to which point the AEW fans were like, oh, we're definitely getting behind him now.
That's our guy.
We're going to see if we can make him as big a star as possible. And
he's
a lot of fun. I think his match against Hobbs will be fun.
How do you see that side of the bracket going? I just kind of walked through the side with Danielson. How do you see that side of the bracket
going? I think 10 versus Moxley is a two big men slapping meat kind of match, you know, kind of what Big E loves to do over in WWE, where it's just two big hosses just beating the piss out of one another. And I think Moxley wins it, but I think it's a fun show. I think that, I think you can have Hobbs beat Cassidy and it not be a bad thing, because you can then be like, he got to win over Orange Cassidy. Like, it's not a common thing. You know, the guy didn't lose very often, despite not necessarily being a main eventer. But Hobbs is like that guy who's almost there.
Yeah.
And I don't know what's missing, but something isn't quite there yet. But he has just every bit of potential in the world. And I think he's going to be an amazing behemoth and to run with. And I think him versus Moxley would be a lot of fun. I
could probably talk for a day and a half about the mistake that I think they made with Hobbs.
Oh yeah.
Because I love Hobbs and I really like him a lot. And I'll just say this and we'll leave it for another episode. I think the mistake that they made was having it be Ricky Starks versus Brian Cage instead of Hobbs versus Brian Cage. And that's nothing against Ricky. I think that they should have made Hobbs and Cage a tag team and maybe even given them a loss against the Young Bucks and then had them slowly deteriorate, break apart, and the FTW belt goes to Hobbs. But yeah, I think Hobbs is really good. In fact, I think if it's not Jon Moxley versus Danielson, I think it's Hobbs versus Danielson.
Yeah, I think that's right. As much as like would love to see Cassidy versus Moxley would be a lot of fun. Cassidy versus Danielson would be a lot of fun, but I think Powerhouse Hobbs, because also that's another way that you can do a great bit of chicanery and shenanigans, is you have Powerhouse Hobbs be the guy who nobody expected to get to the final. And
sure. You know, and I think that could be a moment that would put him over. Right.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't think he's ready to have that win against Danielson. You know, if he can't beat Punk, he's definitely not beating Danielson. But I think Danielson would make him look amazing. Yeah.
I mean, Punk obviously thinks very highly.
Oh yeah, he does. Right? Yeah.
So yeah. And if they wanted to do a match where, again, sometimes it's not bad knowing the answer and where you're going to go. It's just how you get there that's the fun. But if they wanted to do a match where it was really all about Danielson winning while making Hobbs look like a superstar, I mean, that's the night to do it.
Yeah, right? I think so too. I think that it's either that or it's the business decision where you have Moxley versus Danielson as the two ex-WWE guys. The thing is,
and I'm going to go out on a limb on this, and I'm going to say that if the finals are Danielson versus Moxley, Moxley turns heel at the pay-per-view, he wins that match and hands Daniel Bryan his first loss so that those two can start a little small feud.
He hands who?
But at the same time, that Moxley hands Danielson his loss.
Oh, okay, Danielson.
So first loss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not Daniel Bryan. What did I say?
Oh, I'm going to say that for the rest of my life. Whatever. The American Dragon shall lose. You call a guy by the name for 10 years. It's hard.
It's hard to.
I'm sure. Even CM Punk screwed it up. But I think that he'll turn heel. He'll fight in a small micro feud, probably until Revolution against Danielson. And I think that that will set up Hangman Page, because I would probably be willing to bet almost everything I own right now that Hangman Page is walking out of full gear as the heavyweight champion. And if he then beats Kenny Omega, after what we have all talked about and think is going to happen, and then his first feud after that, in which he wins as well as Jon Moxley, the previous champion, at that point, the only ghost left is the ghost of Jericho. And that would start Hangman on a really, really good run, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that'd be a lot of fun. That and the Ghost of Pac.
And possibly, yeah. And I still think long-term, Pac is the guy that takes it off of Hangman Page.
Yeah, once he learns how to book a flight consistently. Yeah.
That's Andrade's
problem. Oh, yeah, sure. That's totally what it was.
Or Chavo's. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it was all Chavo. We're going to blame Chavo for everything.
But the winner of said tournament gets a shot at the AEW championship, which is the biggest belt.
Yeah, baby.
The most prestigious belt. And of course, underneath that, there's the TNT championship. And of course, there is the World Tag Team Champions, and there is the Women's World Champion. And now there is the TBS / whatever meme you want to call it championship that people have been talking about.
To be fair,
about.
That is the TBS logo.
It is the TBS logo. It just looks really kind of funky.
Oh, it does. It does. But it's
and funky. I kind of like that it looks a lot like the TNT title, just kind of slightly changed. Although at the same time, I kind of feel like, this is a bit of the Universal title treatment, right?
Yeah.
Like I'm just not really 100% over on that yet. But that's a lot of championships, right? Two singles women's, two singles men's, and then the tag team championships. That's five. Between everyone, that's six champions, because you have two for the tag team, of course, and math is 1 + 1 + 2 + 1. Are there too many championships is my mid-card question. I watched an interview with CM Punk where he said, and I love this, he was on a YouTube station, please go subscribe to this guy just for the name, My Mom's Basement, which I think is hilarious. The kid starts off and says, "Welcome to My Mom's Basement. I'm here with CM Punk." I think it's a funny way to immediately get people laughing and start to have a good time with the conversation. But the kid does a great interview too. He's a tremendous, tremendous journalist from an interview perspective, I think. And CM Punk asked the question. He said, "Is there too much? Is there not enough? I don't know. Maybe there is a bit too much for my taste, but maybe there's not enough for other people's taste." And I thought that was interesting because that was kind of the first, maybe not PR approved comment from, you know, anybody on the corporate side with AEW. So it got me thinking because, you know, you and I talk about this a lot. I desperately, badly, like cut my left pinky toe off, want to have a Trios championship in AEW. I feel that the Trios championship would allow so much more room and breadth for storylines. So much more opportunities to give people who aren't quite ready for a TNT title run or aren't quite ready for a world title run something to be involved with that's meaningful and help to still get them over and get them working on things. And because AEW is so faction heavy, or, you know, like JR says, you got to have friends around here, right?
Yeah,
I mean, there's so many different little micro factions. It just kind of fits.
Yeah, I agree.
Right. And I still like, the pinnacle for me, the piece de resistance would be the Dark Order would be the Trios champions, and they would run the Freebird rule of anybody can defend them. Like, we don't care. Tonight it's John Silver, Alex Reynolds, and 10. Tomorrow it's Uno, Stu, and, you know, Anna Jay. Like, who knows, right? And I think that would be amazing. But it got me thinking. Then you go from 6 people to 9 people. And if you go to 9 people, you have to have 9 contenders. So now you're talking about 18 people on the roster, fully engulfed and fully involved. And that's just presuming that the feuds are 1-on-1 or 2-on-2 or 3-on-3, depending on the belts, for those titles. You know, we've already kind of seen some seeds being planted about Jade Cargill and Nyla Rose and Thunder Rosa and Britt Baker. And I think they may actually be leading that to the first women's, like, big four-way for the belt, which I think would be pretty amazing because Tony Khan doesn't really like to do that. And they're pretty rare. You know, the match with Pac and Orange Cassidy and Kenny Omega was the first three-way, I believe, for a title of any title, which was amazing. It's a great, great match. But it did get me thinking, as much as I want that Trios championship, am I wrong? Is that too many now? And should we be happy with where we are?
So,
and then the minute I think that, the Bucks come on screen with Adam Cole, and I'm like, nope, there should be a Trios championship, damn it.
So here's the thing. If you put a belt out there, it's got to be defended on television, or it's got to be featured on TV.
Brock Lesnar would argue that.
Well,
but go ahead.
Britt Baker would too, but... and so would Kenny Omega. You know, you go look at the number of matches he's had in AEW. He's wrestled more outside than he has in.
I think Kenny's only wrestled 5 AEW title matches now, I think is what it is.
Something like that.
Really low.
It's a really low number. But, like, he's part of the show all the time. And his feud is part of the show. There are people that you and I talked to a bunch who don't like the fact that he's not the center of the show. You know, that other guys overshadow him. But that's just kind of how Tony Khan books things. And that's a taste thing. I don't have a problem with it because it seems like they rotate through storylines so well in general that it almost like it's based on kind of a momentum swing and a tidal wave bit.
Well, and it hasn't taken away from Kenny.
Right.
I think many people still consider Kenny to be the best wrestler in the world because when Kenny goes, he goes.
Yeah.
He doesn't hold back at all.
Yeah, I mean, you saw that in New York. The thing is in order to have that, in order to have a trios belt, in order to have those things, you now suddenly have to devote time to, okay, how are you going to decide it? You're going to have a tournament? Cool. Is that going to be on TV? Okay. Now you've got, there's already the question of how are they going to do the women's secondary title when they only put 2 women's matches on TV a week? And you've got 9 women?
Which needs to change.
Oh, it absolutely has to change. But the problem that they've kind of cornered themselves with, and this is where suddenly, like, I love Kevin Owens, Kevin Steen. I love that dude. I don't know if there's room for him.
I still don't know if there's room for Bray.
I doubt. I don't think. Also, I don't. I've come to the side of I don't think Bray is. I don't think AEW is the fit for Bray.
I agree with that.
I think Impact, where they let him do spooky stuff, or even Forge the Narrative, where he can do whatever he wants, is a place to be. But yeah, it doesn't. There's not room. You know, you have an entire faction in the Hardy family office, where Private Party are just goons. Yeah. You know, and
this was the team that upset the best tag team on the planet in the first round of that tournament.
Yeah. And that's bonkers. You know, they're over. And in a lot of ways, it has benefited them greatly to be around Matt Hardy because suddenly they don't look too thin. You know, they actually know how to throw a shot now and not look like their offense is just like, well, it's flashy, so you're supposed to take a hit from it. But the fact that, you know, if you did a trios belt with, to me, that team would be Matt Hardy and Private Party. That'd be a fun trios belt, trios team. Also, Matt Hardy with the Butcher and the Blade would be awesome because
or TH2
or TH. No,
he's become. Well, hey, Jack Evans is amazing. I don't care what anyone tells me. I mean, he may not be a good talker, but man, he can walk the walk. So.
I Jack Evans is not who he used to be. I actually like Angelico better.
I like Angelico too.
He's him a lot. And that comes from watching him on Dark Elevation, you know, and
now
seeing him do a lot in the ring. That was a lot of fun.
Ironically, we haven't mentioned the title or whatever you want to call it, but there's a whole nother tournament coming up soon, which is the Owen Cup that they announced in partnership with the Owen Hart Foundation, which I literally shed a tear when I saw that post. I thought that was so cool because, I mean, that was, I remember watching that pay-per-view and I was so heartbroken about what happened. And I remember I didn't watch the rest of the pay-per-view after it happened. It was just so unbelievably sad. And I could go on for days about that situation, but that's going to be something that they've already said is going to be an annual thing, kind of like the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic in NXT. And I think that's wonderful. I think it's a great way to honor Owen Hart and that legacy. But, you know, even if it's something as simple as a trophy, like, you know, the Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal and stuff like that, it's still technically another title or championship. It may not be a belt, but I mean, it's another thing that people will have the ability to claim. The Dynamite Diamond Ring,
yeah.
I could argue, is another one, right?
It's a marker.
It is, yeah. So we'll have to see how that shakes out. So I would love to hear, you know, people who are listening to this, you know, chime in on Twitter, chime in on social media. Let us know. Do you think there's too many belts? Do you think there's not too many belts in AEW? Do we need more? And if so, what do we need? Do we need a women's tag team championship? I mean, Pat said it right. I think more women's matches need to be on TV. It's unbelievable how few and how little amount of actual footage and time they're given on TV, and that needs to change. So,
and the answer is not making Dynamite 3 hours and Rampage 2.
That is not correct.
The answer.
That is factual facts. Okay. As the wise man says, enough talking. It's time for the main event. So this week, the main event is I'm going to talk about a wonderful new game called Clash of Cultures, which is an old game / new game.
I really want to hear about this. Like, a lot.
And Pat's, I hope so, because we're going to talk about it. So, and Pat's going to talk about a really interesting topic. It's remote versus local and how the pandemic changed tabletop RPGs forever. So you went first in the mid card. I'll go first in the main event. And we'll talk about Clash of Cultures.
Sounds good.
And as most people know, I work in the board game industry. And the board game industry is crazy because sometimes things take off, sometimes they don't. And sometimes the things that don't, they just kind of simmer. And there's these little pockets and little niche areas of players that love them. The biggest example to me is a game called The Queen's Gambit, which now is many people's holy grail game. And when I was working at Toys R Us, you could buy it in the discount bin for like $5, which is crazy because now it's on eBay. Like, cheap as you can find it is like $400, $500.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a very good game from a like design and mathematical perspective. It's just it was subjugated to the Phantom Menace license at a time when everyone hated the Phantom Menace. So it is what it is. But what I wanted to talk about is Clash of Cultures is a board game from WizKids. Great company, great game. It is a civilization building game. In fact, it is probably the closest game to Sid Meier's civilization games that you could get. I know they do actually make a civilization board game based on the Sid Meier games, and I actually feel that that's more of an abstract look at 4X games than the actual 4X experience, which is kind of interesting. It's a good game, but it's just I wouldn't consider it a tabletop implementation of what Civilization is trying to do. Whereas Clash of Cultures really does that. You have settlers, you have abilities, you have the ability to create new, you know, areas that have settlements and build up. You have the ability to influence culture between different cities and things. And they do a really, really good job with all that. And the game came out, I think, more than a decade ago now. And it had a great run at its first run. And then it had an expansion. And the expansion was something that people that were the fans of it then were like, oh, you need to have this. Like, it completely takes this game to the next level, right? Like, this was a good game before, but now this game is like, chef's kiss, beautiful, right? It's perfect. And after the expansion, it just kind of faded away. And there was no more expansions. There was no more stuff for it. There really wasn't a lot of talk for it. And that was all kind of happening as the renaissance of board gaming started happening. And a lot of tension started flying everywhere. I mean, it was like gaming ADD. You were trying to like keep up with all the different things that were being released. And it's still like that to a degree. But WizKids just recently decided to announce Clash of Cultures, the Monumental Edition, which is, I called it a modernizing of the game, where they basically looked at the original game, looked at the expansion, and they said, how can we bring this game back to light in a way that is meaningful and is not just us like repackaging it and reprinting it and that's it, but actually update the artwork, update the components, update everything about the game, and make people who are fans of the original want to play this game, but also do it in a way that introduces it to new players. And man, chef's kiss is an understatement. They did such a great job with this game. We have already played it personally 4 times in a matter of about a week and a half, 2 weeks. And it's not short. It's a commitment game. Like we talked about last week, commitments, you know, you got to sit down and take some time. This is going to take 2 players. It would take you probably an hour and a half, 2 hours to play. Mm-hmm. 3 to 4 players, it's going to take you 3 to maybe 4 hours to play. I would say 30 minutes per player for an experienced player, maybe an hour per player if it's not experienced. But the nice thing about it is there is no, what I call, there's no iPhone moment. Okay, I'm done. I took my turn. I'm going to pick up my phone and play something on my phone for 10 minutes while I'm waiting for my next turn.
Right.
There's a lot of things that happen in the game that keep you engaged. There's a lot of things that happen in the game that make you pay attention to your opponents and what they do. And it's just got some really cool things happening in it.
That's awesome.
And it got me thinking about, I kind of pine for this, and maybe it's just because I'm almost 50 years old now, but I kind of pine for the idea of taking these older games and bringing them back. In fact, there's an entire company that is built on that premise, Restoration Board Games. They have remade Dark Tower from the 80s. They're remaking Thunder Road. God bless them. It's amazing. And they take these games and modernize them. And they don't always just modernize them. Like Thunder Road, for example, is Thunder Road from when you were a kid. And it's just, it's all updated components and updated gameplay and stuff like that.
And it's available.
That is true, and it's not $300. So, you look at something like Unmatched from Restoration Board Games. That is a game that was based on Star Wars Duels, which is actually a great game, and to many a person, a grail game as well. And that's Star Wars. You can't go wrong with Star Wars.
Yeah, you like, can.
Okay, Phantom Menace, fair, you can. But, I mean, when it comes to board games, I mean, you're even if you make a bad board game these days out of an IP that big, it's still something that is going to be looked at as maybe a collector's piece for some people, right? Or you just include the right, you know, bits and chits and make sure that things are, you know, collectible enough that people are like, oh, I just want it for those things, right? This new game, Unmatched, did a fabulous, fabulous job of taking literary characters, Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, Alice in Wonderland, King Arthur, Medusa, all these things from, you know, mythology that are both written in literature and not, like they also have, you know, the Invisible Man. They've actually got the InGen and the Raptors from Jurassic Park. So they have licenses. They're actually coming out with a Marvel one as well, but they did these licenses after they made it original, and it didn't feel like a reskinned game. It felt like a game that was truthfully modernized. And to me, when I look at the big picture of what's happening in the world right now with shipping containers, shipping logistics costs and prices and delays and everything else, one of the things that I've said in my day-to-day work, I do a webinar series with retailers, I've said that we're probably going to see more publishers of board games lean into the things that they know are popular and they know sell, and they're going to build and expand those worlds. And I think the second side of that, or the flip side of that coin, is going to be the smart publishers looking at what are the games that did sell and how can I modernize them? How can I bring them forward from 10 years ago. Puerto Rico is a great example. Puerto Rico is getting remade now, and Puerto Rico is a very tenuous game. It's a game that many people in the board game industry love and look at as their kind of their gateway. That was the game that got them into, you know, hobby gaming or strategy gaming and things like that from a board game perspective. But there's a lot of socioeconomic issues with Puerto Rico as well. And when just you look at it, it's just a smidge. Yeah. In fact, if you want to do some research, there's a phenomenal, also a wrestling fan, phenomenal web series called Shelf Stories. Jason Perez does stories called Good Trouble, and he talks a lot about socioeconomics and social awareness and what's going on in board gaming. He has a great video on Puerto Rico as well. I would highly recommend to check that out. But that's a game that deserves to be modernized and could be updated and amended to be much more topical now than just looked at as something that, you know, maybe has, you know, a negative viewpoint on things. I think that more and more publishers are going to lean into things like that, and they're going to look at their back catalogs and they're going to say, what did really well for us 10 years ago? What did really well for us even 5 or 8 years ago? And what could we do to make this more modern or make it more current and make it effective, not to where we're just slapping a, you know, coat of icing on it and calling it a new birthday cake. So I have been extremely happy with Clash Cultures. Highly, highly recommend it. I have yet to win the game. My wife has beaten me all 4 times we've played. She's very, very good at high strategy games, even though she'll tell you she's not, but that's part of the whole con. but it is. She plays the long con. She's like, what does this do again? What does this do? Oh, okay, you're dead. Sorry. You know, so that's the way it usually goes. In fact, our first game was ridiculously close. The game is actually scored in half points. There's all these technologies you can score. You can get a half a point for each one. She beat me 33.5-33. It was super close. And it's a game that even if you lose, you still have a lot of fun with it. And that's just really special to me. So that is my main event. I highly recommend to go check out Clash of Cultures. And ironically, you're going to talk about gaming as well.
Yeah. And just to piggyback off that for just a second, but video games have already done that. I mean, one of the biggest games that came out last year was Final Fantasy VII, you know, where they remade it.
Right now, Metroid Dread, right? It's not a remake, but it's very familiar.
You know, Zelda has done some remakes where they pulled it forward. And the coolest thing about it is, hell, I just played the Mass Effect remaster.
Yeah. Andromeda?
No, not Andromeda. They remastered the entire.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, trilogy. Yeah. The entire series is remastered.
And
yes.
Had so much fun doing it because I'm a better player now. You know, and I
didn't even think about that.
I saw so much that I didn't see the first time around, and it was nostalgic and still also a fresh idea because my eyes are different than they
that's
were
cool.
10 years ago, and you know it's. That stuff matters. The thing is, you don't want to get into a position where you're Disney and you're coming out with, okay, let's do a air quotes live action version of all of our animated movies and not do anything new. You want to continue to have new ideas and new games and new IP, but at the same time, there are games that everyone loves and they're going to want to see it again. And, you know, as the console cycles, as the PC cycles happen, moving that up isn't a bad thing. Yeah.
I mean, just last year, Hasbro did a online crowdfunding for HeroQuest.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, many people, I would say that's another game. It's a gateway game for them that got them into the hobby.
Yeah. I love it. But my gateway towards D&D now is Discord.
Okay.
I'm playing in 2 games right now. I've got a cyberpunk game going using the pen and paper version of Cyberpunk 2077. And then I'm in a legit D&D game. Also, side note, it's really fun when people are like, hey, what are you doing tonight? I'm playing D&D. Because to people who don't play, like, oh, I'm playing Cyberpunk. Are you playing the video game? Or, oh, what's Cyberpunk? It's like, it's just easier to be like, I'm playing D&D. One of the coolest things that a boss did when the pandemic started is that he was a dungeon master and he's done a ton of D&D, and he's the office I work in is full of nerds. And he was like, I'm going to run, canned adventures, and anybody who wants to come play can play. And he ended up with like five groups that wanted to play and did. And they've been having, they had a lot of fun. And there was a bunch of people who'd never played D&D before, never played any RPGs before, and got into it and had fun with it. And some people didn't, and whatever. But I'm still part of the group that started, part of that group. And he still runs the game. And it's been all virtual with like three sessions since really lockdown kind of lifted and, everybody confirmed they were vaccinated and so forth. But it's, and those have been kind of special events almost. But the regular, every session has been remote. And one of the coolest things a lot of the electronic publishing has done, and this has been true of for me for a long time, has been getting a PDF of it so I can look at it on my tablet. So I don't have to lug around a half, 3-pound, 4-pound book with all the rules in it. But D&D Beyond.
Are you going to work out? Or are you going to play D&D? Yeah, what's it? What is it?
What is that backpack full of? My God. But having the ability also to just be comfortable at home and not have to go out and interface with other people necessarily. And it's probably made people who are social, have some social anxieties, get an opportunity to experience the same kind of tabletop RPG that I would have, because they don't have to be in person. They don't have to be in a crowded room or whatever. They can be in their space and feel safe, but still they got, I've got two screens in front of me and I've got my character sheet over here. I've got, notes there. And then I've got the rules that I'm able to skim through very easily. And it's a really comfortable way to do it. You can see everybody in the game. Everybody will have a webcam and it's a lot of fun. And to me, I know that this has been something that people have been doing for a long time. It's just that the pandemic made it something that really midwifed it into a huge deal. Is that
it brought it to the forefront.
It brought it to the forefront because you couldn't go and play in meet space, as it were. You couldn't do it in a real thing. And I think that what we're going to see is applications like Tabletop Simulator, things like the D&D Beyond model, become more and more popular and more accepted. And the tools are going to get better and better because we have now a world where it's easy to have a game where you got three people on one side of the country, three people on the other side of the country. Nobody's in the same place.
Or different countries.
Different countries. Yeah, different countries. Like we did this with one of our guys was in Germany at the beginning of the pandemic, and we got to play with him because he was still in Germany and he hadn't finished school yet. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, it was really fun. And for me, it was great because I got to see these people without having to worry about oh man, are we all going to die? And I mean, we did in session, but that's different. But the idea about it is Tabletop Simulator allows for almost some board games to be, remote. And yeah, nothing beats being in a room with your friends and doing that. And there's something special about that moment when nerds get together and play. And, you talk about the Twilight Imperium sessions, talk about playing with your wife, there's something special about those moments, but there's also some about just the ability to play.
Yes.
And for some people, that's not an option. And fact that it's easy,
it's
now,
not going away.
No.
Right. I mean, you look at Asmodee bought Board Game Arena, which is kind of an online opportunity for people to play board games, very much like Tabletop Simulator, like you mentioned, or Tabletopia. D20 or Roll20 has been absolutely huge. I mean, just grown tremendously.
Yeah, that's what we use for our D&D game is Roll20.
And you mentioned Discord. So when you're playing, I know Roll20 allows you to do things inside of it and do video inside of it and stuff like that. Are you guys using Discord for your communications and then Roll20 for your actual role playing, or how does that work?
Yeah, so we've got the D&D game is you'll have the Roll20 session where we've got the map going. And then we've got Discord because we just found it to be a little bit easier for everybody for the communications piece of it. And then everybody also has all their characters in D&D Beyond. And so you didn't even need to have dice because the D&D Beyond has all the dice rolling for you.
And it's, and you can even make up your own little macros for your dice and have it say things like Big Sexy comes in and swings his hammer, right?
Yeah. Things like that. Yeah, there's a special ring of hell for people like you. But anyway.
That's right.
The fun about it is the fact that the tools are all there. You can build a game relatively easily and everybody can still have fun talking to one another. You know, I'm going to use the same podcast, the same setup the next time we game as I'm using right now for the podcast, because I've got a mic that's way better than anything I have in my head. And I can just sit there and have fun with my friends and have a good time. And it's a wonderful opportunity for more people to get involved. The other thing that D&D Beyond does that's great, that is absolutely amazing, is if your GM is running something and you don't have the materials for it, they can allow you to use their books.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that.
To build your character. So you don't necessarily, like a lot of electronic stuff is limited because you don't have the book, you don't have the feats or whatever. Well,
sure.
If your GM has it, he can allow you access to it. You can then build your character off of that. As things, you know, a lot of times in every gaming group I've ever been in, sharing is totally normal. You know, everybody shares everything. And the D&D Beyond model, like we talked about piracy earlier, that's a way to combat it. You know, I didn't have to pirate these five books to get the information. I just, you know, I'm borrowing my DMs and I'm going to end up buying books from them again, because the experience is so good. The system is really great. And it's that old idea of, if you make it easy for me to do business with you, I'm going to do business with you. If you make it difficult, I'm going to go pirate it, you know, digitally. And
you heard it here first. Yeah. FBI is going to come knocking on your door now.
Yeah, well, all right. But
I would venture to say, so my cousin's a teacher and she's in New York State. And it's been really interesting for me to see over the course of the last year and a half of the changes in the world, how teachers have had to struggle through really being thrown into the deep end of the pool.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I mean,
in like a weekend.
I mean, there's been so many changes that they've had to make where they just have to. It's not even I want to do this or I feel like we need to do this. It's like, I have to do this. Like, if I don't, the kids are getting left behind, or my school's going to get left behind. Yeah. And it's a ton of challenges. In a way, the D&D and role-playing game community in general has kind of gone through that same thing, but it's been this case of, when the waters rise, all boats float, where everyone has said, we're darn well going to find a way to play this game, right? Roll 20, that's one avenue. D&D Beyond, that's another avenue. Discord. I know a retailer that's running Magic the Gathering tournaments on Discord. So Discord is like super powerful if you want to use it for the right things. It's pretty amazing. But I do think, in a way, that the community at large that are role players looked at it and said, okay, this sucks. We can't all get together now. Or like you just mentioned, like Bob's in Germany or Jill's in Poland or whatever, and we want to play. And I think that it's been really cool to see how the community has really come together from you know, really big high-end guys like Joe and superstars that are, you know, on TV to, you know, everyday people like you and me who are just trying to enjoy the game. I think it's been really, really cool to see how that's developed over the years. So I'm actually very happy to hear that you've been able to do that and keep that going in your life, because I know that social just enjoyment is such a big boon to keeping your mental sanity.
Absolutely true. And it's also worth noting to everyone listening, he just dropped Joe Manganiello's name like he was a buddy, you know, like Joe.
And I can neither confirm or deny that.
Figuring that out. And I'm just like, man.
I'll let everybody else figure that out, but I'll neither confirm or deny that. He may have a D20 of mine, but I'll just leave it at that.
Oh, hey, nice. You go to one of cons. Him and I keep forgetting his name. The guy who played Superman, or like the standard.
Dean Cain?
No, the current Superman.
Henry Cavill.
Henry Cavill plays 40K.
Yes, he does. And
he's a complete nerd. And it's great.
If you really want to learn how much of a nerd he is, go watch some of the backstory stuff on Netflix's The Witcher and how he was so focused about, this is the way it's got to be, because I've read the books, I've played the video games, I know all these things. And that's been some pretty, pretty awesome stuff. Although I would feel a little intimidated. I mean, look, Henry Cavill is a way more strong than me and could like destroy me with a wet napkin, I think. He's also beautiful.
Yes, he is.
Like,
he is.
I would be afraid to sit across the table from the man for fear I'd fall in love.
Yeah. Because I'm already like, yeah, you're inching your way towards that Keanu Reeves, Tom Hanks.
You can't look him in the eye too long. Like, you'll fall in love. Well, right, just like Prince.
But he's also like showing into that wonderful group of people that are just like, everything you see about these people is awesome. You know, and they're wonderful. And when we find out that they, you know, have a closet full of dead babies, it's just going to look like, all right, that's the end of the world. I don't know. You know?
Well, that, ironically, yeah. that's why I like to think of people in terms of their first names, like Joe, and like that, because I no one's perfect.
No, right? In fact,
I think I just thought of a topic that I can use for another future show, which is going to be a story about how my wife almost killed Will Wheaton. But we'll talk about that on another show.
Well, wait, that's how you end a show, man.
That's a cliffhanger, right? So speaking of, we're getting here at the end. I want to thank everybody so much for paying attention to us for a little bit of your time today and sharing part of your life with us. And we look forward to hearing from y'all.
Absolutely.
Find us. Go on Twitter, go on Instagram, go on Facebook, Main Event Meeples, look it up. Let us know what you think, what you're enjoying, what you want to hear. If you prefer Pat's sexy voice over my sexy voice, or you prefer Pat's gruff voice over my gruff voice, but we'd love to hear what your thoughts are. I think today was a really interesting discussion. I mean, we touched on everything from unionization to too many championships to how important referees are.
To how sexy Henry Cavill is.
To how beautiful Henry Cavill is. I mean, how much more can you fit in a podcast? All we need is Ethan Page here, like doing the whole peck bump thing, and it'll be a complete show. So, but until we see you next time, thanks so much for listening to Main Event Meeples, and we'll catch you on the flip side, everybody. Be good and do good.
Yep. Thanks for wasting your time with us.